Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We have reached the appointed hour. Have we have a quorum here? We do not have a quorum yet. We'll start our meeting in spite of not having a quorum. It is the appointed hour. When a quorum arrives, we will officially call a meeting to order. Thank you all for coming. Those of you that came on time, thank you for being here on time. I appreciate it. Today we're going to do an overview of the Department of Natural Resources Asset Preservation and Flood Mitigation work, program, whatever you want to call it. And we have Kent Lockishmo here to be with us. If you'd like to come forward and introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Kent Lockishmo, Director of Capital Investment for DNR.
Thank you, Director. Please go ahead with your members of the committee. If you have questions, please get our attention. Kent has agreed to interrupt his presentation if we have questions for him during his presentation. Director, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And what I'm going to do today is give a quick overview of the department's request from 2014, so it probably puts it in a little bit of context, and then focus on asset preservation needs. And following that, I've got a PowerPoint that shows the flood hazard mitigation needs. So DNR's mission, as you know, is to have conservation that works, and we try to balance the three circles here: outdoor recreation, economic development, and natural resource protection. In our capital budget request for 2014, we were looking at implementing the governor's goals for better government, addressing our priorities of maintaining a strong conservation infrastructure, and that gets to dealing with asset preservation, and then also just powering the state's natural resources economic engine. And we have significant unmet capital investment needs that I'll get into more detail on, and also point out that we put money to work quickly, and we spread it across the state. We have facilities in all counties. Our capital asset portfolio for DNR is worth over $2 billion, so it does take a fair amount to take care of that. Taking care of all of our state assets will help improve the delivery of public services, ensure the health and safety of Minnesotans, reduce operating costs, and increase efficiencies. The types of things that we asked for in the 2014 capital budget request were, and these were in the priority order that we asked for, and I guess I should point out that Commissioner Landwehr has made it a top priority to deal with asset preservation and dealing with the facilities that we have, and that is the first request. Buildings and facilities development was the second. The flood hazard mitigation, we'll get into that in more detail. Dam repair, reconstruction, removal, fish hatchery improvements, groundwater monitoring. You'll notice an asterisk by that. Those are the ones that we had requested dollars for but did not receive funding in 2014. And this picture on this one is a forest road in Bedora State Forest. So you see the top part of this is the rather shaky bridge that you might not want to try to drive across, and replaced with a culvert. This was a $70,000 project that was done by a local contractor.
Director, I'm going to interrupt you for just a moment. We now have a quorum attending, so I'll officially call the meeting to order. Representative McGinnis, would you like to move approval of the minutes? Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Virginia moves approval of the minutes of, I had a date here, February 5th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And opposed by the same sign. Thank you. Director, go ahead.
And then moving on for the state's natural resources economic engine, just to point out briefly, the hunting, fishing, wildlife watching activities contribute $4.3 billion in sales to the Minnesota economy. The state trail users generate 30,000 jobs in Minnesota and spend $2.4 billion on travel expenses. State park visitors are spending tourism dollars throughout the state. Forest industry is 60,000 plus jobs And the healthy forests support $16.2 billion of economics. The continuing on our request within last year of state land reforestation, stand improvements, Vermilion State Park, school trust acquisition, and the native seed processing complex, the last two did not receive funds. And then our unmet capital investment needs. There's we probably have $25 million thereabouts to complete the remaining community flood protection projects. And there are other activities beyond that for impoundments that help increase the factor safety of flood protection works. $5 million annually to expand the groundwater monitoring network needed for water supply planning. And that's to finish the a statewide plan would be to have 7,000 wells spread throughout the state. And the $5 million is a step in that direction. The total cost for that is, I believe, in the neighborhood of $70 million. $5.7 million annually to repair the state's 800 public dams. Public dams are those owned by the state and by local units of government. For the state-owned dams, we pay 100% of the cost. For the other publicly owned dams, the program is to spend on a one-to-one match to provide grants for the reconstruction of locally owned public dams. And then $3 million annually for reforestation activities. And this just shows the distribution of our work sites across the state. We've got 225 work sites, and we have recreational facilities in every county in the state. We own and maintain over 2,700 buildings. The capital investment budget investments that we make put people to work all across the state, and the estimates that we've seen for jobs is that for every $1 million spent for construction, that supports 24 jobs. This slide wasn't updated, so it only goes through 2013, but it just shows the brown color is the authorized funds that are already obligated. The blue shown on these bar charts are the unobligated funds as of like a year ago. And for the cancellation report that I know you heard a few meetings ago, for 2009-2010, I think our cancellation number was a little under $2,000, so we've been able to utilize the money and spend it where it was intended to be spent.
Excuse me, Director. I believe Representative Runbeck has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry, your name again was?
Kent Lockesall.
Right. Thank you. You back to the slide on the public dams. So the $5.7 million you're requesting, roughly how many dams are you proposing, and do you know which dams those are at this point?
Mr. Chairman, Representative. Well, it varies considerably. The cost for the repair of the dams would range from Bronson Dam, which we don't have on the list yet because it's still in design, is likely to be a $9 million project. It's in Bronson State Park. It's state-owned. We would pay 100% of that cost. There's other dams within that list that the fix is only $200,000 to rehabilitate the dam. So we do prepare a dam safety priority list that's required by statute to be done by June 30th of the odd-numbered years. So that has been completed, and actually it was just recently updated in January to reflect the results of some recent inspections. So we do have a list that basically you need the $5.7 million or thereabouts every year for the next 20 years to keep up with this aging infrastructure.
Okay. Thank
follow
you,
up,
Chair.
Representative?
No, I'm fine. Thank you.
Representative Swazinski has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Director Lockesmo. Just looking at your slide, looking at your buildings, and you've got just kind of listed 2,761 different buildings. Do you have a rough guesstimate on square footage that we're looking at? I mean, obviously, that's something you can get back to us on, but just you know, from a square footage standpoint, what your
Director Lockesmo.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative, and I can get back specifically on it. I think it's a little over $2 million. But I'll have to verify that.
Thank you, Director. Representative Albright has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Lacasmo, if you could just back up one slide. Thank you. It's curious to me that despite the fact that the authorized amount is lower, starting in 12 and 13, that the amount of unobligated is substantially larger as a percent of the overall bonding expenditure by year. And I'm just wondering if you could speak to why that is occurring and if that's a trend line that we are starting to observe and if that's problematic to the way that we go about looking at projects and whether or not they have merit for moving forward from a year-to-year basis.
Director Lux.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I probably misspoke as I explained what this chart represents. The total bar shows all of the authorized dollars, and the brown is the authorized and already obligated or encumbered. So the blue is the only amount that's unencumbered out of what was authorized.
Representative Albright, a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, to my point, then, if they're unobligated but that they were first requested, what is that money going to be used for?
Director Locke.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the design for the project probably hasn't been completed yet, so we haven't put it out for bid, so it's not encumbered for a specific project yet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Uglum has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Locke-Smo, nice to see you again. Yes, I guess I would be remiss to not ask about the school trust land, land acquisition monies and things that was on page 2 on the slide. Could you kind of update me and give me some of the details on that?
Director Lacasmo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilton, the department made a request to acquire some of the interest in the school trust lands. We've got, for example, public accesses that have been built on school trust lands. So those are lands that are not generating any money for the trust. And so to make the trust whole, we would acquire those lands and continue their use for the public recreation purposes that they have. And then that money would be available within the school trust for those purposes.
Thank you.
Representative O'Driscoll has a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Director. I'm going to follow up on Representative Uglum's inquiry regarding school trust lands. That's becoming a very popular item around the legislature to fulfill the fiduciary obligations that we're charged with by the Constitution and on our trust duties. And I know that the DNR was charged with prioritizing lands as to how they were going to be using those and other assets that are owned by the trust. In your plan and proposal for 2015 that we're looking at today, does it include any monies that the DNR is looking for to reunite fees on properties where there may be school trust lands that are orphaned in the middle of other properties or other projects that the DNR has to put those under state of Minnesota ownership along with the other properties that it surrounds and or buying those properties out and putting forth that prioritization list that the legislature asked the department to put together?
Director Lacasmo.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I may have to phone a friend on that one. And I think we'll have to, because we do have, there have been discussions about how to deal with the trust lands, and I haven't been engaged in all of those, so I think we'll have to get back to the committee on that.
Do you have any friends here today, Dr.
I do have friends here, but...
Director? I see one coming. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. I believe Representative Driscoll was asking about the current governor's budget bonding recommendations.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, welcome, and it's good to see you. Here is, again, what I was looking at is the DNR was charged with putting together a prioritization list of acquiring properties from the trust, and some of those might have been reuniting properties that the state of Minnesota may own around or that might otherwise be creating some management-related issues because we have two separate owners, one by the trust and the other. My question is pretty straightforward. Is there money in this proposal today to implement that plan that the legislature charged the DNR with in helping to acquire? I realize that there's DNR monies for DNR properties, but some of those properties may need to be purchased from the trust or the like that the bonding monies may be able to be used for. So I'm just looking for an update on that, if your proposal includes any of that or where we might be at.
Director Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Odrisco, we're presenting a history of our bonding proposals, not a governor's bonding request here today. So we have submitted requests for bonding funds to buy out those lands in the past. They have not made it through the process. We also are waiting for final comments from the Department of Education for the report on the $1 million that were appropriated last year within the supplemental budget to expedite some of our school trust fund activities. I believe some of those dollars are going to be recommended to work on the BWCA exchange, which is moving forward faster than we thought right now. So that will expedite and change some of that land management ownership. But right now I cannot speak for the governor's 2015 capital bonding request, as that's not been finalized yet.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Meyer, it's good to hear that there is going to be some conversation on that because, as Representative Uglem started with the conversation today, this is a very important item to the legislature, and it seems like every year it gets a little bit more traction of watching out for the kids and their interests on these properties. So I for one, know I'll be looking forward to seeing and discussing that proposal. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just a little bit on that background. We have done the research and the report. I believe it's presented to the Permanent School Trust Fund Committee. It's estimated to be about $53 to $80 million needed to buy out those trust lands that do have environmentally sensitive to the trust. So that, I mean, that's kind of the package you're looking for, $50 to $80 million, and how that's done. It'll be the Permanent School Trust Fund and the legislature and the soon to be hired Trust Lands Director at the Department of Administration, who will be working on those issues.
Do you have a date? A hiring date?
Mr. Chairman, Representative O'Driscoll, committee members, we're finalizing the PD. It's one of the things we hope to be discussing at Monday's meeting at the Permanent School Trust Fund Commission.
Very good. Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, you had indicated that there's between $55 and maybe $80 million needed to do that. If I'm not mistaken, the legislation also asked for a plan to be able to have that done in 5 years. We might be 3 years left in that five-year plan. So, again, I want to underscore the importance of that to myself and to apparently a lot of other legislators who are sitting on this commission as well today. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Director. Director Lacasmo, go ahead.
Thank you. The as part of our capital budget request, like I said, was asset preservation. And the department's definition for asset preservation is specifically to natural resources. And this is something that I believe Representative Hansen authored several years ago. And it's much broader, so it's not just buildings. It's for all of the DNR's assets. So it would include trails, water control structures, roads, bridges, all types of assets. And this slide just shows the statutory definition, and it includes things like code compliance to meet the accessibility ADA requirements, do hazardous material abatement, air quality improvements, energy efficiency, the building infrastructure repairs, but then also repairs to trails and bridges and other improvements to land. We have estimated that our natural resource asset preservation needs exceed $500 million a year over at least the next 10 years. We've got the 2,700-plus buildings. That's $13.7 million annually for rehabilitation can be spent. We have 3,000 miles of roads, 100-plus road bridges, $2.5 million a year. There's 590 miles of paved trails. And there's 100 miles that are in very poor condition. There's one section on the Cicada Trail down by Waterville that is in such poor condition that people are riding on the highway instead of the trail. So it's there are those types of examples across the state system that we need to address.
Director, I have a question for you from Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to your point about the paved trails, what seems to be the the life cycle of a typical paved trail? How often are we requiring now to resurface that?
Director Lacasmo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Runbeck. 20 years for resurfacing. The Waterville Trail, for example, I mean, one of the things that happened there is it was an old railroad grade, and they didn't scarify the bed as they constructed it, so it's very, very uneven compared to how you would construct it today. But 20 years is probably a reasonable life. You may have to do a little bit of resurfacing and repair in between that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have a question from Representative Oglem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, with regard to the trails, I'm a big snowmobiler and four-wheeler guy, and you do receive some revenues from those particular groups. Do you receive any other revenues that can go into maintaining these trails?
Director Lacasmo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there are well, certainly, I mean, there are legacy funds. There are water recreation funds that go into those types of facilities. So there are other sources of funds, and I'd have to provide some better detail on that if I could.
Representative Obama.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, Director Lacasmo, I was really kind of speaking of user groups. In terms of people that use the trails, other users, do you get any revenue from them?
Director Lacasmo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Oglem, there's some revenue that comes in. How much of that and what it's available for, I would have to verify and get back to you.
Okay.
Sorry,
a follow-up, Representative?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, for instance, bicyclists and other people like that, do they get a sticker or pay anything or anything like that?
Mr. Chair,
Director Lacasmo.
Representative Oglem, there are no fees for bicyclists or rollerbladers or whatever to utilize state trails.
Representative Volk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Director, curious, when you put together an acquisition plan for properties, is there an operational plan put together at the same time so that it looks at the ongoing expense of projects?
Director Lacasmo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I guess it may depend on what type of properties. I mean, certainly, I mean, we buy property for a myriad of activities, whether it's a wildlife management area or a trail or a park expansion. And certainly, I mean, some of those have plans to how to utilize all of the property. We buy for a wildlife management area, for example, if there's buildings on that property, we have a plan on how to address those buildings or wells or septic systems that are on the property as we acquire it.
Chair, Mr. Director, I guess what I'm looking at here is if a lot of these things seem to be accumulating from year to year, and there's only so many dollars to go around, and if we're going to acquire property, then wouldn't it be prudent to have a long-term plan on how we're going to maintain it? Because infrastructure always causes overhead, and if we don't take both of those things into account, we end up with these large bills that are hard to pay. Is there anything being done or thought to be done as far as matching before an acquisition is done a long-term operating plan to know where the funding is coming from?
Director Lacasmo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we are in the process of developing a plan to address the asset preservation needs going forward for all of state facilities. So that... And that's looking at, the trails that are in dire circumstances in need of replacement now, but next year there'll be some more that get added onto that list. So we're in the process of developing a 10-year plan for all of our facilities. And part of what has been done, I think I'll get to it in a couple more slides, is that the department administration has a process that all of the buildings in the state have been assessed on a uniform basis. So there's a way to compare the relative condition across the state system. So we have that information that's just recently become available. We're currently doing the analysis, but it rates buildings on a scale of 1 to 5, 1 being very poor and 5 being excellent. And we've got so many in each category. So that process is proceeding.
Mr. Chair, just one more follow-up.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you. Mr. Director, so what I'm wondering, though, is going forward, if we're going to make an acquisition and we don't have a plan for the ongoing operating cost, is there something in the works now that when we, before we make the acquisition, that we actually have an approved plan go with the acquisition so that we know if we're spending $1 million for something that we're going to have to expend another $1 million over the next so many years and where it's going to come from?
Director Locke.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, as part of our strategic land asset management system, we are taking a more comprehensive look at acquisitions, so we look at the total picture.
Director, specifically to the legacy funds for trails and the maintenance of those trails that are acquired by the legacy fund, is there any opportunity to use legacy funds to maintain the trails that the funds acquire?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Good.
Continuing on, the annual asset preservation needs, you know, we've got nearly 5,000 campsites and 87 campgrounds within our 66 state parks. That would represent an annual need of $5.5 million. There's 188 sanitation shower buildings for an annual cost of $4 million. 725 vault toilets, $870,000. There's 505 paved water access sites. Rehabilitation of those could be $4 million a year. And for state trails, I think I've already mentioned, it's about $200,000 a mile to do the rehabilitation. And that's without looking at bridges. And bridges are the expensive parts of those. And that could be a $3 million a year.
Director, Representative Hansen has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Director Lacasmo. On the asset preservation, if we appropriated money there, how fast could you move? I'm assuming fixing roofs and rehabilitating the toilets and those type of things, you're hiring local contractors. If we appropriated money this year, how quickly would there be people out there working, making those fixes?
Director Lacasmo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, the much of those dollars could be put to work pretty quickly. There still is design that needs to go into even a roof. So there are some, but some of those are relatively easy designs that could be done quickly. Resurfacing a trail is a relatively easy design. So much of it could be put to work very, very quickly. Some this fall, the majority in 2016.
Representative Wiginius has a question.
Mr. Chair, I'm looking at the 505 paved public water access sites. In the past, when DNR constructed many of these access sites, they turned out to be great gatherers of water and drained them right into the lake. So you were contaminating the lake. So there, we gave DNR money to figure out redesigns so that that would not happen. So when you're using asset preservation money, will you be using the old, just a repaving an old conduit to the lake, or will you be redoing it so you're not putting water into the lake, just gathering water up and putting it into the lake?
Director Lacasmo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wiginius, we would be meeting the current design parameters. So we would be dealing with stormwater on the site. Ultimately, the water is going to go in the lake, but we want to treat it first. And we would also want to have sites developed so you could treat for invasive species on existing accesses if there's area available to do that.
Thank you.
Director, I have a question. It's kind of a sideline, but I understand that at some boat landings, there's a problem with erosion where the boats are gunning their engines to get up onto their trailers, and that backwash is scouring out the bottom of the lake. Is there anything we can do to prevent that?
Mr. Chairman, you know, certainly you could extend the ramps out further, so then the concrete wouldn't erode as the sand does when they do that. I mean, people are encouraged not to do the power loading of boats, but I don't think it's a practice that's going to stop. So the alternative would be to have more coarse material at the end of the ramp, whether or not it's concrete or you know, more coarse gravel, so it doesn't get blown out by the prop wash.
Thank you.
This is just some examples of old buildings. This is the Glenwood office building. You can see it's not ADA accessible. It's got poor heating, poor ventilation. There's a lot of stuff that's not code compliant. It's not rodent proof. This is the Ortonville storage building. This was flooded, and following the flood, you have mold, you have other problems. This is just a typical road washout. This is a forestry road that high flows end up taking away some of the pavement. This is a Heartland State Trail Bridge, the Steamboat River Bridge. You can see the the end of the red rod that's sticking in is probably a 5-foot long rod, so that rotted piece is not in very good shape. And when we find these, we often have to put load restrictions on these bridges until they can be replaced. This is just one of the old dams in the system. This ends up being the blowdown at St. Croix Park. And what I'd like to go back to is on the facility condition assessments that we've done across the state, we ended up, as I said, they rate those in five categories, with the number one being the worst case, the crisis condition. We have 215 buildings that are in that in the worst condition. And the deferred maintenance value on that, according to this process set up by Department of Administration, is $17.7 million to address those 215 buildings. And in the poor category of buildings, we have another 540 buildings, and that would have a cost of $37.2 million to address those deficiencies. So in the worst two categories of buildings statewide, we have $54 million plus of needs in the very poor and poor category of buildings. So out of our 2,700 buildings, we have 942 that are in average condition, 729 that are in good condition, and 276 in excellent condition. And what the whole process, they looked at all of the facets of a building, the roof, the treatment systems, the heating, ventilation, rated everything, and then a cumulative rating got to these overall ratings for the buildings. But as you can see, there's a significant unmet need for our asset preservation.
Representative Runbeck has a question.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Lacasmo. So on that topic, going back to the Glencoe building, I mean, it appears to be one that's in poor condition. And I guess I'm wondering, do you look where opportunities like this might be to abandon a building and then go to just leasing space in the city somewhere? I'm certain there's office space available.
Director Lockesmall.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, we look at all options. This building is on site of the hatchery at Glenwood, and so there's a need for having staff on site. So we are looking at rebuilding this at this site. But on other places last year's discussion, we looked at and we received some money for pre-design looking in Rochester and Bemidji and other places. In Rochester, there's 11 agencies all in leased facilities. So we're looking at options down there, whether or not it makes sense to build, buy, or lease. So we evaluate all of those options and see what might be the most effective for everyone.
Okay. Mr. Chair,
Representative
Lacksmo, any idea, you probably do, of the ratio of leased facilities to owned?
Director Lacksmo.
I would say generally we're in owned facilities, but we can get back to the committee with some specifics on leased versus owned.
That would be just fine.
That would be helpful. And, I mean, it does seem as though if it's not specialized workspace, that leasing would make more sense to me anyway.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you. Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Lacksmo, when we're talking about buildings, I'd like to just ask you a couple questions about the building I drive by almost every weekend, the Walker. The city of Walker, the new DNR building that got done there this last year or two, beautiful building. But in many cases, I can see where you go through design and maybe hire an architect or whatever. But in that particular case, a lot of big native trees, pines were cut down, and the whole planting structure was. Of course, native grasses and everything else, it looks really nice. However, it's right on the edge of the city. It just doesn't quite fit in. It seemed to me that it's a wonderful, beautiful, big facility, but it seems that in these tough times, we probably spent quite a great deal of money on that maybe we didn't have to. Do you guys put out for bid with the architectural firms or design firms? Do you put that out for bid, and how do you evaluate the design and the cost benefit?
Director Lacksmo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I believe the building you're referring to is a federal building in Walker and not a state building.
Is it federal? I thought that we had DNR people in there too.
There may be, you know, maybe we're leasing space from the federal government, and we have done that in other occasions. I know we have some leased space from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Detroit Lakes. But the building in Walker is a federal building. But for our design, we do much of the design internally, but then we also have some projects that are bid out for architectural services and specific design services. For example, the mechanical systems in a building would be something that's contracted out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, then with my neighbors up at the lake, I can blame the feds for that cost overrun. Thank you.
That'd be appreciated. Thank you.
Director, I know that in many sites you've added solar power or wind power as a power source. And approximately how many of those installations or what percentage of installations do you utilize that type of energy?
Mr. Chairman, for wind, we only have that in the facility south of Marshall at the park. And that malfunctioned, I think that's being rebuilt right now. In solar, we have we have made a commitment to increase the amount of solar energy. We have a New Ulm office, for example, just put in a large array. We have an array at Grand Rapids. We're doing some at Itasca. I can get back with the specific number of megawatts, kilowatt hours that we have and number of sites.
Thank you, Director.
The other thing as far as buildings that I should mention, one of the things that we have is a third of the buildings in state parks are on the National Register of Historic Buildings, so they are more expensive to build than or repair than something without that designation.
An issue.
And we also, internally, we do charge divisions based on the number of square feet that they occupy, a maintenance charge. So we have about $3.5 million a year that the agency uses to do some of the emergency type work and the stuff that's not bondable. So there are things that we are funding with our own funds that and not using bond dollars for.
Thank you, Director. I believe you've finished your first half of the presentation. Are you ready to go on to the flood mitigation? members, you should have a second packet of sheets with the slides from his next presentation. Representative Hausman, while we have a little break here, you brought some material to committee. Would you care to just review that with us?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I always like to see history when we're talking about it. And so last year we asked, and I think it was Mr. Lacasmo who put this together. It may have been him or staff. I'm not sure. And it just shows, one of them shows projects in the Red River Basin, and it's local share, state share, federal. And then you see the totals and then the rest of the state. Just to give a sense of what we've accomplished so far. Just thought it might be interesting as background for...
So this is strictly flood mitigation and strictly in the Red River Valley, is that
no,
correct?
No, one is Red River, and then the first page is Red River, and Mr. Chair, and the second is in projects outside the river, Red River Basin.
I
so
see.
To get the total, you'd have to add the total on page one and total on page three.
And this goes all the way back to 1997.
Correct.
Through 2014. It's kind of small print, Representative.
Yes. We're testing your eyes.
But if I get my bifocal lined up, I can read it, so that's good. There, well, after that little commercial interlude, we now will continue with Director Lacasmo's presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll give a quick overview on the flood hazard mitigation grant program. And Pat Lynch, who administers this program in DNR, is in the audience to also answer questions if need be. The flooding is a number one disaster, natural disaster in the United States. It's $8 billion in damages and 89 flood fatalities per year in the United States. This picture is of the Red River of the North in 1997, which we all remember as a very large event. One of the highest crests on record, however, incurred on the Red River near Moorhead was in 1897, 100 years prior to the 1997 flood. So between 1957 and 2014, there have been 42 flood-related federal disaster declarations in Minnesota. This picture is a picture of the city of Rushford in 2007. Here, the city of Rushford had a Corps of Engineers design levee. It was protected to the 100-year flood elevation, so many of the people behind this levee didn't carry flood insurance. That levee was overtopped by a larger flood. And you can see the result. There was the entire city then was flooded. And we've done some improvements to their project, and it's about $3.5 million worth of additional work has been done down there, and $2.7 million of that was through the flood mitigation program. This flood mitigation is cost-effective. The FEMA study shows that every $1 invested in mitigation is worth $4 in savings. And since 87, we've removed 3,400 structures from the floodplain, and that's been our one of our highest priority items to do, is to move them out of harm's way instead of trying to control the flood. And there's thousands more that have been protected by various other structural means, levees, diversions, flood walls. The examples include in the city of Austin, we've paid $13 million of total cost, $6.5 million of local funds and $6.5 million from the state, to remove homes from the floodplain, and those efforts avoided $7.3 million in damages in 2010. The city of Oslo along the Red River of the North has their project was built for $3 million in the mid-70s, I believe it was, and the Corps has stated that they've avoided $78 million in damages since then. We're in the process of reconstructing those levees to move them away from the riverbank to make the city meet current standards. And then 2011, Moorhead flood update has shown that since 2009, they've saved significant funds because of the work that we've done. And the Moorhead project is completed. To the best of our knowledge, they just got money last session, $7.2 million last year. And that is to complete the entire project in Moorhead. And the state and federal, or state and local money will be about $105 million spent in Moorhead. But they are very well protected now.
Representative Howe has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess my question, it seems like I continue to get the emails from those folks up there in the Red River that there's still that ongoing battle with what the North Dakota is going to do with the Army Corps of Engineers. And how does that relate to our projects here? And what effect is that going to have on us, on our side of the boundary there in our state?
Director Lacus.
Mr. Chairman, Representative. The federal project is a diversion project in North Dakota. So it takes water from essentially around the two cities. Since 2009, we embarked on protecting the city of Moorhead through levees and pumping stations and flood walls. So they're pretty well protected. The diversion project that the federal government is looking at with the combined cities there will provide a greater level of protection. It'll divert a lot of the water around town. The water that goes through town will be much lower and much more easy to contain. So they'll have a greater factor of safety. The piece of that project that's growing much, or that locals out there have had lots of concern over, is to make the project work, they're putting a dam on the south end of Fargo-Moorhead that will impound water and hold it so it can gradually be released around town. To do that, they're going to temporarily inundate 50,000 acres of farmland, some in Minnesota, some in North Dakota. Those people have raised concerns over those impacts and whether or not they'll be properly protected from damage. So the we're in the process of doing a state environmental impact statement, and that's required because the dam that they're going to build to temporarily hold these waters is a high hazard dam, and it's a mandatory EIS in Minnesota. So we're in the process of doing that EIS, and ultimately, I guess after that, we would have to evaluate permits and options for the project.
Representative Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I learned a long time ago, to an ill effect of, for me, to always get the definition of terms, because your definition and the federal government definition and my definition of temporary might be all different. So when you say you're going to temporarily hold back water, what's your definition of temporary?
Director Lacus.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, this would be done for a springtime flood, is when the issue is in Fargo-Moorhead and on the Red River. And you're right, I think the definition of temporary varies significantly. They're looking at several weeks of inundation. And obviously, close to the dam, the water levels are 10, 12 feet deep, and it gets shallower as you go further south. And the Corps of Engineers, when they calculated their 50,000 acre feet of inundation, just included the areas that were inundated by more than 1 foot of water. So you're right to be cautious about definitions.
Representative Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can understand their concern up there because, you know, there's a lot of estimations that doesn't quite work right. And when they estimate a two-week inundation, especially for farmland, that really takes a long time to dry out. And in your application of seed and trying to get back into the field, and especially at later times, really delays your ability to what crops you can grow and how that plays out. So I think that's a very important thing for us to be concerned about on our side of the line there. Thank you.
Representative Hansen has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director Lacasmo. I think Representative Hausman had prepared showed a local share and a state share, and I was intrigued by your comment about Moorhead with $100 million, and I think I've been around long enough where we've heard this is the last $50 million needed, and then there's another couple years and it's the last 50 needed. And I think in Representative Poppy's district, the city came forward with a local option sales tax and to help pay the cost to get the job done. And I'm just wondering, with that $100 million of state dollars, was there a local option sales tax to help get the job done in Moorhead or in any other these communities where we're spending a lot of state money?
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Hansen, in Moorhead, and I'll get into the cost share more specifically in a few slides here, but the statutory cost share is 50-50, and that has been varied by rider language to include a different funding scenario. That is 2%. The local share was limited to 2% of the median household income times the number of households. And when you look at Moorhead, that number, actually it started out at about $8 million of their local share. When we got the new census number in 2010, we adjusted all of these based on the new census numbers. So we used the best available data. Their number jumped up to about $12.5 million. And actually out of the 100, and the city then sold bonds. They don't have a local sales tax for this because they also are trying to compete with Moorhead on sales. But they passed a bond to fund flood protection, and the city has about 30 plus million into that project, and the state has 72 or so. So out of the total of 105, there's about 35 from the state and 75 from the, 35 from the city of Moorhead and about 72 or so from the state.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And some of the other large projects, when we move up the valley, is there any other, are most of the local communities bonding then going to the property taxpayers to pay those bonds off, or is there other revenue that's generated to pay for those local shares?
Director Lacasmo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, I think it's a combination of funding sources. There's some bonding, and on some of these small communities, the local share is quite small. I mean, for a city like Halstead or a Climax, it's under $100,000 or in that ballpark for a $3.5 to $4 million project. So the local contribution is quite small on many of these.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it appears we're variable where we are around the state responding to flood and preparing for future flooding, which is going to happen. There's differences in how the local communities approach this.
Director Lacasmo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, yes, it is variable. The legislature, though, since about 1998, has included that 2% rider language for most communities. And some communities, like the project in South St. Paul, their 2% number is very large, so that ends up being a 50-50 share. Austin, it was basically, it equaled out 50-50 or 2% was about the same number. So many of those, we look at doing the 50-50 until they would get to the 2% number. But most communities and most small communities have exercised and been able to use that 2% funding option.
Representative Wagenius has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to the EIS that's being done on the dam and following up on Representative Howe's question, in Wilkin County, they have a really good drinking water source. Their groundwater is in good shape, as far as we know. How are you approaching protecting that or analyzing the impact on that drinking water source with your EIS?
Director Lockesmall.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, I would have to go back and look specifically at the EIS, and I can do that and provide it to the committee, but I don't believe that issue is addressed.
Representative Wagenius.
I don't see how in this day and age we can't be addressing drinking water, the groundwater, because if water is going to be held on the land, I don't know what kind of soil that is. I mean, is it sandy soil or is it loam or whatever? We need to know how fast that's going to go into the groundwater. Are these how close is the groundwater to the surface? I don't know the answer to the questions, but it seems to me that you cannot have a complete EIS until some of those questions are answered.
Director Lockesmall.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, our state EIS is supplementing the federal EIS, and it may have been covered in that, but I'll look at that question and get back to the committee.
Thank you, Director. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. One of the reasons I bring that up is that at some point, I mean, I know that Moorhead itself has looked with coveting eyes at the Wilkin drinking water source because it was so good. And if they are going to have problems, we ought to just be watching out.
Thank you. Please continue, Director.
The flood hazard mitigation program started in 1987, and we've completed many projects across the state. Like I said, we're looking at removal of structures from the floodplain first, and then providing permanent protection through structural means as a second. The cost share that Representative Hansen was asking about is specified in law as a one-to-one local match. Federal projects, we would then be splitting the non-federal share of a federal project. And as I said, that rider language that's been in the bill since 1998 has used this 2% of the median household income funding scenario. This just shows the history of flooding and this, or history of funding to address flooding. And the big spikes in funding on this occurred after major flood events. 1998 was the first big amount, and certainly then in 2009 and 10 and 11 when we had relatively large flood years. And this chart includes both general obligation bonds and general fund, and includes the regular and special session funding. We have funded flood mitigation after federal disasters.
Director, have these bars been adjusted for inflation at all?
Mr. Chairman, no. These are the actual appropriated amounts.
Straight dollar amounts.
Correct.
Thank you.
This just shows the distribution of projects across the state. The red are the ones that are completed, and the blue are in progress. And what we've done on funding projects is to fund complete phases that are of benefit by themselves, and to fund it as they're ready to build. So you can, and the dots are where the flooding has occurred in the state. The top flood risk areas, the most repetitive damaged sites in the state, were Rosso, East Grand Forks, Warren, and Breckenridge were probably the top four prior to this project, and they now all will have permanent flood protection. This is a picture in East Grand Forks after the flood. Basically, the floodplain's been vacated as now is a state recreation area that is floodproof. This is Montevideo. The The red dots show all of the homes that have been acquired. This is the Smith addition, which has basically been vacated by the, where the floodplain's been vacated. This shows the city of Oslo during the 1997 flood. The city doesn't have access other than by air or boat during a flood. And but this levee around town has avoided $78 million in damages since it was first constructed. And this is a picture of a flood impoundment project. This is the Agassiz Valley project that's up near the city of Warren in the Middle River, Middle Snake Tamarack River Watershed District. And this just holds water so you can let it out into the system when the threat of flooding has declined. And we have, you know, talked to, you know, various cities and done a survey of our grantees, and there's significant support for the program. We've made a lot of progress in the state. The, you know, Moorhead, Monty, Austin, Rosa, Warren, Crookston, all have protection that they can rely on. The, you know, when you see floods now, we aren't hearing about all of the impacts that we've had in the past. There's it's pretty much a non-event in most communities across the state. We're looking at, as I said, about $25 million would provide the base level of flooding to communities in the state, and there's would still be additional funding needed for impoundment projects and some of the watershed district projects. And the floods and the standards change. I know FEMA is looking at some new standards for even determining what the 100-year flood is. So some of those happen. What happened in Rushford, you had a larger event, so you don't want to be tied just to a minimum level of protection. And that is the last slide. I put this on there because there is a light at the end of the tunnel. I know we've been saying that there's been a lot of flood funding in the past decade or so, but we are nearing completion of the community flood protection.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it fair to say we are moving more away from dikes and more to impoundment in terms of what how we mitigate?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman, well, yes, because we're almost done with the community protection of needing the levees and the pumping station and flood walls. So the remaining work that can benefit and reduce future flooding would be managing the water on the land through impoundments.
And, Mr. Chair, my understanding is that we're beginning to understand, particularly in a place like the Red River Valley, where when the flood is gone, they have no water, and so holding the water on the land is a smarter way to deal with it. Isn't that part of the motivation, at least in the Red River Valley?
Director Lockesmore.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman, certainly they go from flood to drought conditions relatively quick there, and holding some water on the land and allowing infiltration is a benefit. And most of the projects now that are built have multiple benefits and include natural resource enhancement type benefits, so there are broader benefits than just the temporary flood impoundment in the spring.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back a couple of years ago, we were talking about 300 or 400 or 500 year floods in the span of 10 years or so. And that's because our projections were not up to date. And my question is how up to date now are our projections of what really will be based on what we now know about global warming and the impacts on major events? How up to date are we and confident are we of the level of projection we're making?
Director Lockesmo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius. One of the issues that we've long had with floodplain management is the term 100-year flood event, because people think that it only occurs once in 100 years, and it's actually just a probability that it's got a 1% chance of occurring in any year, and any year starts new every day. So it is just a probability. We are getting better. We are doing remapping within the state. We are looking at new hydrology. I know for the Fargo-Moorhead project, They looked at using different hydrology and shortening the period of record. So they looked at what's happening more recently are larger, more often flood events. So they did take that into account. And the FEMA standard that they're looking at amending in federal rules is asking that they take a look at climate adaptation and climate changes in determining what those events are.
Representative Wagenius.
I understand the, 1% issue. I think the thing I'm looking at is our projection of rainfall was so off. And we were basing our decisions on data that was so old. And now I think I'm hearing you say we have not updated that because we're looking at FEMA to make those updates. And we know the federal government is slow at best. So, but that's not helpful for us when we're doing our budgeting. So we have wonderful folks at the University of Minnesota, starting with Mark Seely, and I mean, these are just fabulous scientists. Do we have, talking with them, working with them, do we have up-to-date numbers on rainfall and how it's going to impact us? Basic question.
Director Locke-Small.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, we have a climatology office within DNR that's actually, situated over at the U that works closely with Mark Seely, and they continue to work. I know what used to be called TP40, which was this old chart of rainfall intensities, that has recently been updated. We continually work on that. And we are looking at the climate, climate changes and how that's going to impact future events. So it is a work in progress.
If I could,
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. Okay, work in progress is fine, but have we now updated? Given what we know, have we updated our projections of what we will need to spend on both fixing problems from floods and then in trying to prevent them from happening? So there are two things here, but my question is DNR using absolute up-to-date numbers in making its projection?
Director Locke-Small.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius. As we build flood control projects, we build in a factor of safety. So they're built to 100-year, for a levee, for example, it's built to 100-year level plus 3 feet of freeboard. So there is room for different size events. And clearly in the Red River Valley, 3 feet of freeboard is a significant amount because it's very flat and the water spreads out and doesn't bounce up as much. So we are doing that, and we are looking at continuing to build impoundments and build other means for on-land storage of water, and that adds another factor of safety into the community protection. So we are looking comprehensively at, I think, several aspects to provide, at least for flood protection needs.
Representative Gaines.
I just feel like you're not answering my question. I'm looking at Austin, Minnesota, for example. Are we using the most current projection of rainfall events and saying to this committee and other committees, we are basing our projections of need on the most up-to-date rainfall science? That's my question.
Director Locke-Small.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, the to some degree, I mean, it's hard to answer that question because the design of these projects is done by other consultants. These aren't done by the Department for Flood Hazard Mitigation. It's a grant program that goes to local governments. So To some degree, yes, but I think we'll have to look at what actually has been used in some of the recent projects and provide you some more information.
Thank you. I think that would be helpful so we understand, you know, what the real number is out there, both for preventing floods on one hand and on the other hand, paying for them when they happen.
Thank you, Representative. We'll work on our crystal balls and see if we can foresee the future. Director, can you tell me how individualized these flood projections are as far as, you know, when you make changes in one part of a system, it often has an effect on other parts of the system. I'm thinking of the big ditch, for instance, is probably going to have an effect downstream.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, that certainly was looked at, and one of the first proposals at Fargo-Moorhead for a diversion around didn't take into account or didn't have any upstream storage. So that had stage increases of, you know, a foot and a half downstream, and actually the stage increase in the flood would have carried all the way to the Canadian border. So they went back to go to Plan B, if you will, which was to create this dike and dam on the south side of town and store water, so you limited the impact on those downstream communities, but then you're trading off an impact on upstream farmland and upstream communities by having that impoundment area. So the impacts of the projects are evaluated, so we aren't just passing a problem around.
And so my question is, are these 100-year levels individualized by community and adjusted for changes in the structures?
Mr. Chairman, yes, they are individualized per community. And then when a structure is built, you would have to do a reanalysis of the numbers for stage increases.
Thank you. Representative Hansen has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Lacusmo, have we completed the LIDAR funding for the whole state? Have we mapped the ground cover for the entire state, or are there areas that have not been completed?
Mr.
Director
Chairman,
Locke,
Representative Hansen, I believe that is completed.
I believe so, too. Representative Hansen.
And Mr. Chair and Director Lacusmo, so throughout the state there's different areas of fall from where the water falls and how it gets to areas where it's retained and floods. For example, in Maurer County and the water that flows south into Iowa, you've got a variable topography, and you've got large ditches that have occurred through those areas, and you've got a bounce that occurs, but you can kind of track that because you've got a different fall than in the Red River Valley, where the fall is fairly shallow. So retaining water on the land, I think we've had testimony in previous years about measuring where we could put structures and how we could hold water back. And we've invested as a state money into RIM WRP to try to do that. Now that's essentially gone, or the old model is gone. So how do we slow that fall around the state? If we're still, it seems like we're still in this challenge of build the dikes higher. If we don't have some preventive or retention up gradient where that water is coming from. And it also applies in metro communities as well, when you've got the roof and the sewer systems. What's the plan there? I mean, how do we deal with that if we don't have those federal state matching dollars like we had before?
Thank you, Director Lacusmo. This will be your last question.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hansen, the you know, in the Red River Valley, if we look at that specifically, there was a provision in the Farm Bill to provide some cost share dollars for impoundments and those types of work. So the watershed districts within the Red River Valley are looking at storing water on the land and equating and getting a 20% reduction in flow. It's a long-range process. It would be 96 some impoundments to get there. So it's and that's building the impoundments like was on the slide here with Agassiz Valley, those large impoundments. And for other types of cover would be a benefit to slow down water flow, but what we're seeing in the valley, and actually there's some impoundments proposed down in the Austin area also to control some water down there. So it's not just limited to the valley, but the proposals recently have been to construct those larger impoundments. And there isn't anything really for just general land cover that's going to slow up the water flow.
Director, I believe our next testifier will have some more information about the Red River Valley and the impoundments therein. So thank you for your testimony today. Mr. Harnack, would you like to come forward? Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ron Harnack. I'm a project coordinator for the Red River Watershed Management Board. It's a 9 watershed district joint powers authority in the Red River Basin. And one of their primary goals and objectives for establishment was to provide comprehensive and coordinated flood damage reduction and water quality enhancements for the Red River Basin. I want to just echo some of Kent's perspectives here. The flood damage reduction program has been a very, very significant benefit to the state of Minnesota. Preventative measures far, far outweigh our ability to continue to fight after the flood has occurred in these instances. And we've seen, at least in the Red River Valley and certainly in other parts of the state, that the monies that we have put in, we do not see the kind of flood damages occurring anymore like we did in the past. And we do take a look at the climatic changes that we're seeing in terms of precipitation, in terms of snowfall. And we have updated all our hydrologic models for the Red River Basin and the individual major watersheds to address those. Because as we look at building water storage facilities within the basin, we have to understand not only what the spring flood is going to do, but also what the summer flood events are going to do. Because we try to build these as multi-purpose projects. We look at certainly the flooding issues, the damages downstream, trying to prevent those, both to rural infrastructure, to agriculture. And these impoundments do provide a significant additional risk reduction for the communities that have levees. We don't expect we should have to come back and build levees higher because our climatic conditions are changing. Our perspective is we should be storing the water on the land to prevent any increases from having an adverse impact on those communities. And I think we're being successful towards that end. We did complete for the Red River Basin a couple years ago a comprehensive flood reduction strategy. That calls for a certain degree of protection for our communities. If we had looked at some of these issues 30 years ago, maybe 40, there's probably some projects that we would have suggested we relocate some of these small communities rather than trying to build a levee around them. But we're past that point in time today. So we're almost to the point where we are completing the permanent, I hate to use the word permanent, a significant risk reduction levee control for a majority of these communities. As we look at just this, and to answer a question before, so we got the structural measures on it, and then we got the non-structural measures. And our non-structural measures are looking at holding the water as much in place as possible. When you're dealing with Glacial Lake Agassiz, which is heavy soils and flat as a pancake, it's very difficult to just say we're going to put a small control structure at one spot and expect to hold a lot of water. What we're doing is we're building four-sided dikes and we're bringing water in to those impoundments and then gradually releasing those so that we can enhance the biological integrity of some of our rivers and streams in the Red River. You can see, if you look at the Red River, and I had some photos to show, but I told Gavin, my flash drive, something happened to it, so I couldn't recoup my stuff. But the Corps of Engineers back in the 50s and early 60s channelized just about every major river in the Red River Valley. And the intent of that was for the benefit of some communities, but also a significant benefit for agricultural productivity. Now, today, none of those would ever be done. And unfortunately, the purposes for which they were originally intended are not occurring today. Because of the way they straightened channels and did not deal with sediment control, we're having more localized flooding than before. So what we are doing as part of our overall flood damage reduction strategies is saying, let's also restore these natural resource areas. So we're building a large impoundment. Some of you saw North Ottawa, which is about 3 square miles worth. We're building another one called Red Path, that's about 3 square miles, but is also restoring 9 miles of the Mustinka River that the Corps channelized way back when. We're going to manage this impoundment for waterfowl production, northern pike spawning, flood control, as well as providing a certain portion of it to be retained in agricultural production. We need to be able, when we build these projects, to provide for the long-term O&M, rather than just having a pure reliance on the tax base to provide for that long term. And we're being reasonably successful with that. On one of our projects, we have only had to twice in 10 years had to adversely impact the farmers farming of that. And then we reimburse them for their costs, because certainly they're not eligible for flood insurance when a government entity comes in and, you know, is going to flood them out in one way, shape, or form. So our projects receive a lot of local support. They receive a lot of public support from the agencies, from local conservation organizations, and from the communities that are providing that this protection is be provided for. I know next week, according to Gavin, we're going to get into some of the individual projects at your hearing next week, and we'll go into some of these in greater detail. I'd like to just hit on a couple issues that I think are important going forward. Is we believe we're going to receive about $5 to $10 million over the next 5 years through USDA to assist in some of our floodwater retention water management projects. Some of that may be solely for the natural resource enhancement components because of the limitations and constraints of those dollars to deal with the floodwater retention itself, but at least it will be something that can help defray part of the state and local cost. The other element is, and you heard from MMB a while back regarding some issues of concern regarding potential for private use and some of the impacts that has on general obligation bonds. One of our issues that we have is we want to be able to have projects that can accrue some revenue for long-term O&M. And we would like to establish O&M funds. One of the things that we are constrained from doing from MMB currently is that anything on an annual basis that we take in that's above and beyond our minimum annual maintenance has to be returned to the state. And I think any of you who know who manage public projects or familiar with roads and so forth, you can't deal with that just on an annual basis. You really need to look at the longer term O&M for a project and how can you deal with that. So we're hoping that we can kind of work something out with MMB on that, or even some legislation that can help us deal with those issues looking at long term. This year, I know the governor hasn't got his proposals out. However, working with a number of the communities in the state and looking at what we feel this year, for the calendar year 15 or FY16 construction season, we believe there's a need of about $15 to $17 million for flood damage reduction that could be significantly spent this construction season if we can get those commitments out there and get things moving forward. And we'll be talking about some of the specifics of that, I think, more next week, looking at some of the specific projects that that you'll have before you. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll be happy to answer questions. Hopefully, when I can recoup my PowerPoint, I will get that to the committee. And I apologize that didn't get here.
Mr. Harnack, could you just give us kind of a concept of, in the big picture of the Red River Valley, how much retention you have installed to date and how much you think we should be thinking about installing over the next 20 years or whatever your time frame is?
Okay, Mr. Chairman, when we did the comprehensive flood damage reduction study for the Red River Basin, we felt we needed 1 million acre feet of storage that would achieve the 20% reduction in peak flow on the main stem of the Red River. If you take that and split that between Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota on some distribution basis, feel half of it, you know, about 40% on the Minnesota side, or 45% Minnesota side, 45% North Dakota, and South Dakota's got a small area, so that may be somewhere in that 10% range. We have got about 200,000 acre feet of storage in place in the basin today, and that's counting one project that's also a 30,000, about a 20,000 acre foot project that's not in place yet, but we got the land acquired for it anyway. So our cost is estimated about $1,000 per acre foot. So you can see that there is a significant cost going forward as we look at this.
So by my rough math, you're about just shy of halfway. Is that?
We are not quite halfway. When you're talking about 1 million acre feet, and you know we've got about 200,000 in place. So.
How are our neighboring states doing?
I'm counting them at this point in that 20%.
Oh, I see. So we're not doing so well.
No. But the other thing I think that, you know, ties in with this is the Basin Commission is also working at a water quality strategy for the Red River Basin. You know, we accomplish a lot of other benefits with water retention and holding it on the land, and water quality is one really key benefit that's associated with it. We have a real struggle right now because Minnesota's laws, rules, and regulations are far more restrictive than those of North Dakota. And we really need to work towards getting some consistency and uniformity with it. I know you've seen some bills on the table saying, you know, for some of these border cities that maybe they should be given some leniency, because why should Moorhead have a higher standard than Fargo discharging into the same river system? And so some of these all relate together as we look at floodwater storage, look at water quality, we look at drainage. You know, it's all part of water management in the basin, and I think we're doing a pretty darn good job of trying to bring all that together through the Watershed District's efforts that we have ongoing.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Harnack. Eventually, don't we run into some challenges both with quantity and quality with our northern friends don't we have a treaty with Canada that requires us to be managing both quantity and quality before we send them our water?
Mr. Harnack.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hansen, I understand that there is, and the IJC Red River Water Quality Group is continuing to look at that, and I expect we're going to be hearing more from our northern neighbors as time goes on, as they've completed their major study on Lake Winnipeg. And I think that's why it's even more critical that the Red River Basin Commission, which is representative of Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Manitoba, really look at a comprehensive water quality strategy for the basin, because we're not going to be able to do it alone. And the advantage of doing something like that is like we did with flood. Every major watershed in the basin has a flood retention allocation. There's no reason why we can't have a similar water quality reduction allocation for each major watershed that contributes to the water quality issues of the Red River in the north.
Representative Hansen.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Harnack, so if North Dakota didn't want to come into compliance, if we achieve our goals on retention or even in the future quality, because it's a federal treaty between the United States government and the government of Canada, isn't there some way of achieving compliance through federal action with North Dakota?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Harnack.
And Representative Hansen, I mean, that throws it into a much different political arena. You've got the IJC that, you know, they have various compacts and so forth that they deal with, and certainly there could be some issues that come through that mechanism. I think we've got a good structure in place to move towards that. We just need to make the effort to get there.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, it seems like they're sending us the oil and we're sending them the soil. And we should be able, with our, I think, number one trading partner to figure this out on a level beyond just the state. And I think we've funded as a state, and we support, and we'll probably continue to support the collaborative organizations working between the states and with the Canadian government. But at some point, I fear they're going to, as they develop the data, you know, again, as there's more science, more data, and we can measure everything now in the valley, that at some point we'll have to have some decision making for all states.
But Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, North Dakota has bought fully in with our flood damage reduction strategy for the basin. And what we found in many instances on five or six of the projects that we have already got in place, that the water quality impairments, particularly for turbidity, downstream of those impoundments, are gone. So, you know, we are making significant efforts in those cases in reducing that yield, you know, that goes down the Red River. And we just need to continue that and be strategic about, you know, how we approach it.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you. This is a good long-term issue to be discussing. I'm glad we are. I mean, at some point, this does not have to be a treaty. I mean, we are kind of locked in thinking about that. But Canada can sue us. Certainly, North Dakota felt very free to sue the state of Minnesota, which they've done. And if North Dakota isn't doing its fair share on water, well, why aren't we thinking of suing them? I mean, why are we taking the hit?
Mr. Harnack.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Wagenius, you know, certainly litigation is an option everybody has on the table. I guess, you know, my hope would be is that we have been able to come to agreements on how to manage other aspects of our joint resources across the borders. You know, we should be able to do it also for a water quality strategy. We've done it for flood. We've done it for some other issues. I'm hopeful that within the next few years we should be able to achieve the same for water quality.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, I would wish we were hopeful, too, but that's not the way North Dakota operates, and we have to recognize it. That's not their thinking pattern. I mean, they sued us, so we have to understand that that's the way they think. And I don't like Minnesota to be in the position to kind of be naive or, you know, that we can be easy to bat around. But that's certainly the way North Dakota is treating us right now.
I did not hear a question in there, Representative Guinness, so we're nearing the end of our time. But
I think it's something we all have to think about. If we're doing as good stuff and North Dakota is not doing good stuff, then what, and we are going to be tagged with it in Canada, so supposedly is our friend, then do we just stand there and take it, or do we respond?
Time will tell. Hopefully this multinational group can work through some of those problems and get everybody at the table. We know that North Dakota is not selling as much oil right now, but they're selling a lot more cigarettes, so maybe they'll be able to fund their work on their side of the border.
Well, Mr. Chair, they're selling a lot more coal, too.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, maybe we'll just increase the cost of the frack sand we send them.
All sorts of possibilities. I'd like to bring Director Locksmall back up for just a moment. Director, you've got this. I've been looking at your picture here displayed up on the screen, and I see that you, I assume that you assume we're moving through that tunnel towards the light. Are we sure that somebody's not just adding more to that tunnel as we proceed?
Mr. Chairman, we know which communities have flood risks in the state, and we believe that we've addressed those. And the lists that we have, we deal with the applications that we've received for assistance. So basically, we think that the $25 million for community assistance will finish the known projects that we have.
Very good. Representative Lilly, welcome.
Mr. Chair, very briefly, any way we could impose a mandate that 1% of that water ends up in White Bear Lake?
You can pass anything, Representative Lilly, but having the outcome that you're looking for is not always possible. With that, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your attendance today. Thank you to the presenters. This meeting is adjourned.